Sometimes the most interesting stories get left on the cutting room floor. I'm Julie Amacher. Each week I share a new classical recording with you featuring some of the world's best musicians on new classical tracks. I'm counting down six of my favorite interviews from 2016. It's New Classical Tracks Uncut, giving you a chance to hear more about your favorite musicians and their newest recordings. This week, a conversation from February of 2016 with pianist Alain Grimeau. Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for your interest and time.
Well, let's start off by talking, you know, I just want to dive into your new recording. Tell me a little bit about what made you focus on water as a primary issue.
Well, first of all, it was the beauty of the repertoire. Having grown up without playing these particular pieces, but playing some others to do with the theme of water, it was something which I always wished to explore. And of course, once I got down to it, I realized how many pieces there actually were, many more than I realized at the time. And it was just the beauty, the poetry of of this music, which led me to wanting to, you know, make a program out of it and a recording. That was the first motivation.
And was there a second motivation?
The others sort of grew out of this as a sort of logical, sort of intuitive sort of feeling, which is that, you know, once you start to think about water as a source of inspiration and as a metaphor, as it was for all these creators and artists who were inspired by it, you of course cannot help but start to look into simply water as a source of life, as the most essential resource that we all depend on, and then it becomes something else. You know, it morphs into a sort of artistic invitation for a greater awareness about water and the lack of it and how difficult it is for so many people on this planet to actually have access to water and to, you know, to drinkable water. So, and the demands of, you know, heavy industry and the ever-growing world population. So there, of course, then it becomes an ecological, I don't want to say fight, because I'm really not an activist on that front, but at least the hope that it's another way of bringing this to the forefront of people's consciousness.
Creating some awareness, huh?
Yeah.
Do you? Where are you based? Where do you live?
I was living in Switzerland until this past year, and then came back to New York, actually, to Westchester County.
Because when I started to dig into this recording and started to think about how, you know, oftentimes we take advantage of the fact that we have fairly easy access to water in this country. And then, of course, I started to think about all of the stories behind Flint, Michigan, and I didn't know if you had been following that.
Yes, of course. I mean, those are more recent developments, but if only what's going on with, you know, California and the West and how difficult the situation is there with water. I mean, there, you know, yes, we take it for granted in this part of the world, certainly in Europe as well. You turn on the faucet and you don't ask yourself, where is it coming from? Where does it go back to? And that's a major, you know, a major issue, obviously. So, and it is so easy for us to just not think about it just because we're so incredibly lucky.
Well, so there are many composers who have written music inspired by water. How did you go about choosing the pieces that you did for this recording?
Yeah, that was quite difficult. It took me a long time because there are so many beautiful pieces, and it was so hard to make a choice. And it seemed so arbitrary, and I kept, you know, oscillating. One week I wanted this piece, another week that other piece, and I realized, okay, I have to find a line for this choice, some criterion of choice. And I wanted as many composers represented on the album as possible, and that meant only one excerpt, one piece per composer. That in itself was hard, because there could have been so many pieces from Ravel or from Liszt or from Debussy alone. Could have made a whole album with only these three composers. It was probably one of the most difficult aspects. And in the end, I decided to go with the what I considered, in my humble subjective opinion, the more stylized, the more abstract pieces. So I tended to go away from the more narrative ones, such as Ondine in the case of Ravel, or Saint-François de Paul marchant sur les flots in the case of Liszt, and many others, even though they're all equally beautiful. But that's how the choice came to be. And at the end, it also needed to be a program where, even though, you know, all these pieces have different proportions, in duration, exploitation, even though it's a very ugly word, but of the pianistic resources of the instrument, that it's they still needed to all merge into one world, one uninterrupted program, because even before the transitions from Nitin came to be, when I was playing the program live, for example, at the Park Avenue Armory in New York, where the program was recorded live, they were played without any interruption. So it started with the first note of Bassa Clavier of Luciano Berio and ended with the last note of The Sunken Cathedral by Debussy without any interruption. And so it really created one larger piece, if you will. So, you know, they had to find these connections, and it's but the repertoire is wonderfully poetic and evocative and atmospheric and deals with so many of the aspects of water and the different incarnations of water, except perhaps for the destructive power of that element, which is not represented here, but all of the others are, certainly.
You do seem to represent water in a more powerful way, though, even through the performances of these pieces, which in some cases, like the Ravel, you know, sometimes they're performed in a more, for lack of a better word, delicate fashion. But your presentation of it is a little more direct, a little more forceful. Do you agree with that, perhaps?
Yes, I do. And actually, I'm happy that you mention it, because it's true. I feel, you know, there is that raw, raw nature of the element that you feel. And it is. I mean, this is what makes water so fascinating. It is an irresistible force. It's ever-changing. It has this impermanence, this ability to, I mean, it is a driving force of all nature, and it's full of paradox, because it can be so sweet and so violent at the same time. And so when you feel, I mean, even in Les Jeux d'eau, for example, in fact, indeed, the Ravel piece, you have to always feel that power which is lurking. And it is far from just a, you know, decorative element. And so, yeah, so I'm happy you hear that.
Well, and it reminds us to be respectful of this resource that often has power over us. I want you to describe for me the live setting in which this recording was made, because it's very unique. And I found some photos, but I didn't find a lot of visual images to go with this. So I'd love for you to describe it and what you were feeling and experiencing as the water started to fill in the room.
It was quite a mesmerizing experience. I mean, first of all, you have this tremendous, absolutely cavernous space of the Wade Thompson Drill Hall in the Park Avenue Armory. We had done a piano test there, had brought in an instrument, and, you know, surprisingly, it actually sounded quite good in spite of that tremendously large space around the piano. I mean, the piano seemed like a toy in the middle of that hall, but. You know, once the installation was created by Douglas, it was something extremely powerful. His approach was very humble. It was a very pure way of treating the subject. And it, you know, the installation became part of the program, in the sense that the first 10 to 15 minutes were actually simply that, the space being filled by water. So you could see the water seeping through the seams of the floor. And so it was, you know, it was quite mesmerizing. You had these glistening, you know, puddles oozing out of the floor, and then all of a sudden, you know, sort of merging and creating new shapes. And I think it had quite a hypnotic quality, and it really helped to put people into a different place to receive the music. You know, most of the audience was suspended in midair on that balcony, and by the time the floor of the armory was flooded, you couldn't tell. I mean, you lost all sense of orientation. You could not tell what was the ceiling, what was the floor. The beautiful industrial ceiling of the space was reflected, of course, on the surface of the water. And it was like being in a matrix. And it was profoundly affecting. And I think, I mean, not only for me while I was playing, but I think from, you know, most of the feedback we got for the audience as well. And it was particularly fitting for that repertoire, because again, the repertoire itself is so fragile, so vulnerable. It was sort of a favor that was done to the music, because again, I believe that people were more ready to receive it and to accept it. And when you hear the first notes of the Berio, I mean, you know, I've played the program in the traditional pure form, and I had my doubts about how difficult it was going to be to you know, take the people along for that journey, and it worked beyond my expectations. But there was a very special atmosphere in that hall, and so, you know, and in fact, I mean, it wasn't even planned that this would become the sound of the recording. This recording was made initially for archival purposes, and then once, you know, we listened to it, it was astonishingly good. I mean, it wasn't the DG sound, but it was so special that I really wanted those two incarnations to be united on the recording. So the on the one hand, the partnership with Nitin, but also the collaboration with Douglas, and, you know, both are now connected through that soundtrack.
So I just have one other question about the actual performance. Was there literally water, like under the piano and around you? Like if you put your foot down, would you be in the puddles?
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I mean, it was very ingenious. It was done so beautifully. And I mean, the armory is such a fantastic space because it made everything possible. And it was, you know, it was quite a challenge. Instruments, I mean, pianos are fragile too. And they react to everything, every change in temperature, in humidity. And so you can imagine with this amount of water being, you know, being pumped into the hall and drained from the hall a couple of cycles per day, the piano was subjected to tremendous temperature and humidity variations, so it was quite a challenge from that point of view. And yes, I had to step through the water to get over to the piano, but the piano was the wheels were touching the water, so the piano was basically on a stage which was at water level, submerged, but the water was not touching any of the wooden parts of the instrument, only the wheels. But it was it was quite a technical feat.
It sounds like it. And so I have to ask, did they recycle that water?
Yes, they did, absolutely. The same water that just came in and out, yes.
I would imagine you would have gotten, created quite a stir otherwise.
No, that would have been terrible. No, absolutely, it was recycled.
So you talked about the conceptual artist, Douglas Gordon. He was one of your partners. And the other is Nitin Swani. Tell me about how the two of you became musical partners and why the transitions he created are so significant.
Well, I've been a fan of Nitin's music for many years. I think the first time I heard his music was 2001. I think it was either Filter or Prophecy. And then, you know, kept following his music, his projects. I mean, he's really a boundary crossing composer and producer. Is intensely musical. I mean, I always, you know, think of Nitin Soni as someone whose every, you know, cell is musical. I mean, he plays so many different instruments on such a high level. Knows the classical repertoire. And just has such an incredible diversity of language, but has also a very, very sensitive and very intuitive language. And so when I started to think about this program and the different ways of living it, if you will, I asked to meet with him when I was in London for some concerts, and lucky that he happened to be in London at that time, and we talked about it, and he understood immediately what this was about, and So the idea was to invite him to compose these bridges, these transitions between the pieces, to help sort of weave all the different poetic and philosophical perspectives of the program into one cogent musical ecosystem. I mean, again, not that it needed that. This was the experimental aspect, but I wanted to invite someone from you know, our time, who didn't have a sort of classical contemporary composer identity. But what really made me want to have Nitin specifically was that I think his work is just a beautiful synthesis of different musical cultures and traditions from around the world. And I thought that was a beautiful way to underline you know, the universal dependence on water. And so that's how this came to be.
I thought it was, as I was just listening to the recording from start to finish, I really enjoyed the transitions. Mm. I know I read different reviews about them, but the one in particular that really caught my ear was number 3, which is the 6th track on the recording where he integrates guitar. And can you speak to any of these transitions and describing, you know, what effect they might be trying to create?
Well, no, because I don't really want to be you know, telling listeners what they're supposed to be feeling. It's a little bit like with the classical pieces. Yes, they have a title, but that's why I gravitated towards the ones that were, again, less programmatic in nature. And what I love about these transitions is that they're so so respectful of the original material and so incredibly creative. I mean, each one is you know, a totally different language if you listen to the sounds and the way they're being used and the instrumentation. So it's quite a beautiful mosaic, which you know, just makes the journey even richer. And every transition is something which certainly you could, you know, consume by itself, just like any of the pieces on the program. But if you take time to listen to it in its entirety, it's just a wonderful journey, and so incredibly varied. It's really mesmerizing.
Well, I want to talk about some of the metaphorical significance behind some of these pieces. I mean, I made some notes about each of the tracks as you helped to provide us with some of those notes in your final bonus track there. But are there some in particular that you would like to bring to our attention?
Well, it's very hard for me to choose, because if I start with, I mean, I could tell you I have a, you know, particularly soft spot for the Berio or for the Liszt, or you know, the Liszt conceptually, because I mean the piece is wonderful, but also because of, you know, the fact that it starts with this as an Epicurean artifice, as, you know, water as a decorative element, but then it morphs into water with all of its redemptive qualities, and this you know, this possibility of rebirth and regeneration ends in a totally mystical place, you know, in certainly in Liszt fashion. So there are many different reasons why I felt so close to all of these pieces. I think that the sweet sadness of the Berio is utterly poignant, because it reflects the, you know, the impermanence not only of water but of the human condition. And so, you know, these are only two examples, but it's very difficult for me to pick favorites.
Well, I want to ask you about the Janáček, because as you're talking about choosing pieces that, you know, didn't necessarily have a program that went with them that would allow our imaginations to sort of run a little bit, what you said about that had to do with the mystery during the act of storytelling, and there's a sense of nostalgia in that piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the most touching pieces, I think, on the program, because it has this haunting melody, which is, I mean, in a way for me announcing the sunken cathedral and everything that was lost. And you know, it is a piece inspired by personal loss as well for Janáček, but it's extremely poetic. The melody is, as I said, just haunting. It sort of gets a hold of you and doesn't let go. And it has this beautiful sense of, you know, oscillating movement that comes from the left hand. And even though it's relatively short, it has an amazingly strong sort of lingering quality in its emotion.
Well, you mentioned the WC, and I thought it was actually, this is the one that really struck me as I was listening to your little descriptions of them at the end, and you refer to that as a lost temple of beliefs turned haunted kingdom.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I felt that it was in a way fitting end to the program with the ecological aspect in mind, because it is the most ominous of all pieces, and it talks of, again, what was lost and what was, but also what could have been. And so it's I think it's a very, very strong piece, and what he's able to achieve with these chords is absolutely sublime. I mean, it's just still one of the most, I don't want to say avant-garde, that's not the word, but just a very original piece by Debussy. And I mean, God knows he was one of the most brilliant composers ever, and had facilities beyond description when it came to composing. But this piece is quite minimalistic in the language that it uses, and creates an incredibly powerful atmosphere.
You mentioned earlier in the live setting that it was a very moving experience for those who were there. Can you share any specific story that someone shared with you after the performance?
Well, because it was, you know, not a traditional piano recital in the sense of, having full lights at the end and acknowledging the applause and coming back and playing encores and then seeing people in the dressing room. I mean, it wasn't that kind of context. It was something quite austere about the whole experience. So I had, very delayed feedback, except for few, family members and friends, also from Douglas's side, but it seems to have. I mean, it's difficult for me to say that because it sounds a little, just self-congratulatory. But it's this experience was so much more than just what could have been created with a piano recital. So it has very little to do with me in the end. But people seem to really be, what's the word, transported? I mean, I know that's a strange word, but it really seemed to take people elsewhere for that period of time, and bring people back to their inner core and inner silence. So people seem to really have been moved in a different way, and having felt themselves absolutely vulnerable and this much more sensitive because of it.
It's interesting because the last time you and I spoke, you had mentioned how we spend a lot of time being human doings rather than human beings. And it seems yes. to me like you're making your point here. You're giving us a chance to be a human being in this experience.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your time. I know you need to go on to your next interview, and I so appreciate all your wonderful comments.
Thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm counting down my 6 favorite interviews of the year. Next week, a conversation with Irish choral conductor Desmond Early from October of this year. I'm Julie Amacher, and this is New Classical Tracks Uncut.